raise a couple more to the revolution.
We have only three words for you.
Uh-oh.
We're taking over!
The world is alive.
Why not raise a little hay?
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to another edition of the Q0 Theater Cast. This is your host, Artistic Director Dan Pelletier, here today with another interview in our, I guess you kind of call it a pull back the curtain series, where we're, you know, getting to know different types of people in the theater, what they do, and why they're important to both expand the knowledge of our theater going listeners, and maybe also if you're thinking of going into a field in the theater but you're not quite sure what, maybe this will give you a little insight and ideas on just all the different positions you have in the theater. So last night I had the great pleasure of interviewing a young budding designer whose work I think will be seen throughout New England for years to come. I don't really want to ramble on too much. I want to let the interview speak for itself. So now I'm going to throw it on over to my past self and let you guys all enjoy learning a little bit more about designing for theater. We are here today to discuss designing for the theater, and I've got a very special guest who's going to be, you know, doing some back and forth. Justin, why don't you tell the good people, who you are, what you do, and how long you've been doing it.
Hello, good people. I'm Justin Lehue. I am a scenic properties designer, carpenter, occasional technical director. I've been working as a scenic and properties designer for around, I want to say, the past 4 or 5 years now. So I'm still kind of early in my career moving forward.
For those that might not know, maybe kind of give just a general overview of, you know, what your typical jobs and responsibilities are on a production.
The way that I typically like to describe what I do is that I am sort of a key member in helping the director and the creative team fully realize the world of a play. So that can happen in a bunch of different forms. I can join a production where the director is very keen on the concept that they want to move forward with. If there's a particular world, there's a particular color scheme, sort of the overall environment that the audience is going to be immersed in when they come to the theater. So sometimes directors know exactly what they want. And then my job in that case is to take that vision and turn it into a reality. So it's to form essentially what's called different drafting packets, which are basically drawings that show how things are being built. Very similar to how an architect or an engineer would take plans for a house and create that into a reality. We're kind of doing that with the world of a play and the world of a musical. There are other times when the director doesn't really have a firm concept on what they want. They have a couple of different aspects and they say, I really want it to feel like this. I want to feel isolated. I want to feel the melancholy of the script. Then my job at that point is to say, okay, so how can we create a world in which all of those feelings are met, in which we can honor the concept, honor the original sort of world of the script, but still put our own spin on it and create a more unique, immersive, and dynamic experience for everybody. We're essentially creating the worlds in which all of these actors are going to be performing.
I love it. And you know, there was some great description in there and some other things that we'll expand upon as we're discussing. Let's take a step back, though, and just kind of talk a little bit more about your story itself, because I think that's where we get a lot of listeners that enjoy hearing, like, how you got into this, what inspired you, and then, you know, where did your journey take you from there?
Yeah, I started out as a performer from a really young age, and so that was kind of my entry into the theater. So I loved acting. I loved singing. I liked dancing. I wasn't particularly good at it, but I liked it. and so I participated in a lot of different productions, whether it was plays, musicals, readings, things like that. And it was really my love for design kind of stemmed out of that. I think what you'll find and what I've found when talking with a lot of other designers, carpenters, stage technicians, is that they started out as performers and then it kind of came out of necessity, where it's like you're in high school and somebody needs to build the set, right? Somebody needs to paint something. And so that was kind of the role that I tended to fill when I was, I think I started when I was around 15 or 16. So that was from a younger age, kind of filling in what I saw, what we needed. It wasn't something that I really fell in love with until a little bit later in life, when I was continuing to pursue these productions as an actor, and I started to actually look around. It wasn't so much looking out at the audience, but it was looking at kinds of the worlds that were created for me and the worlds that I was placed in. And so I really started to develop an appreciation for all of that, a respect for the extreme creative control and the difficulties that come with staging a play and creating a world. And it wasn't really until I went to go see, it was a production of, well, Natasha Pierre and the Great Comet of 1812, which sadly closed on Broadway prematurely. I went to see it in the last week before it closed. I actually quit my job to go see it. And so it was a wonderful time. They required 90 days notice before taking a day off. And I was like, I have to see the show. It's going to close. And so like, I'm sorry. I'm like, well, I guess I have to leave my job. Best thing I've ever done. So I went to New York and I went to see this show. I was lucky enough, if you're not familiar with Great Comet, the stage design by Mimi Lian, wonderful designer, it's essentially like an immersive Russian club. And so there are some seats that are actually on the stage. And so there's kind of these varying different levels and this really immersive environment for everybody. So I was lucky enough to get one of those seats sort of on those benches. And I was watching the show, just being completely taken aback by the world that these people had created. The vivid lights, actors were dancing all around you. They were throwing pierogies in the air. They were throwing papers at you. It was something that was so immersive. And there was one particular moment when the character of Natasha is going into this song. It's a little bit in the middle, maybe beginning middle of the first act. When she's singing about her love, and when she's singing about her dedication to this man, it's I believe it's called a No One Else is the song. And so she turns her back, and as she starts singing about the moon, she hits the high note of the moon. And then in the audience, there were individual, almost like tea kettle, like tea lights, like those small little lights, just thousands of them that right on that high note, everything else fades away. There's a beautiful blue light that's cast on Natasha. And then the audience just sees a sky full of stars. And it was I instantly started crying. Mm. It was one of the most magical moments I've ever had in a theater, where just to take the practical aspect of just a tiny little light, but in this one moment with all these people in this room, it really creates this totally unique experience for all of these people. It was from that moment I was like, yeah, no, I have to do this. I still enjoy performing, but it's this creating these worlds and creating an experience where someone can really take away that just raw feeling. That was so, so incredibly fascinating.
I think I would hope that we've all had some, you know, similar moving experiences and have gotten to see just how the design and technical elements of a show can really transform, be transformative, as you spoke. And I also appreciate, you know, talking about that, you started as a performer. I don't find that there aren't a lot of youth programs out there that have, that start people off as designers and technicians. And sometimes that transition can be difficult. Some people either aren't ready to admit that maybe acting isn't for them, or bringing that out. So, like, were there other, before you decided to go into, like theater production and things like that, like, what kind of, what were some other things outside of theater that you enjoyed that you might have brought back to the theater?
Yeah, I think it's a great question, because there's, especially within scenic design, really any form of design, in order to be a good designer or a well-rounded designer, you kind of need to apply so many different interests and so many different hobbies. I find that some of the designers that I've worked with and talked with are some of the most quirky and interesting and just totally crazy people. And it really benefits their work. I mean, they're fantastic. There are a couple of things. Surprisingly, I wasn't a big painter or drawer when I was younger. which is funny because that's a lot of what I do nowadays. But I was really big into woodworking. I think that that element of creation and that element of making was huge. My father is also big into woodworking, and so he taught me a lot of what I know. And so that aspect of carving and kind of creating these really cool things was a really big part of my process growing up. I always loved architecture. I loved looking at buildings, looking at how the world was kind of created. Mm-hmm. And so seeing all of these different influences was really big for me. I wasn't a big fan of museums, but art museums, they kind of grew on me when I was a kid. And then growing up, kind of seeing all of these really, really intricate and fascinating things that people were creating.
Let's now shift gears and kind of talk a little bit more about the process. And I mean, you kind of alluded to it a little bit as we started, but like when you're fresh on a show, where does the designer start? Like what, when they're just like, all right, I'm bringing you in to design my set for Macbeth or Glass Menagerie or, you know, this new show that I've written, you know, what's your process like? Like talk me through like starting points, what you need, and where you go from there.
It does vary from project to project. But I think that the baseline really is the script. Sometimes it's an old work, if it's Macbeth, and we're going back to Shakespearean roots. Sometimes it's something completely new, and sometimes the script hasn't even been finished yet. But typically, the starting process, a director will ask me to come on, will send me a script to take a look at it, and I'll read it. Before I start designing, I read the script maybe 2 to 3 times. It really depends. The first time is just for pure enjoyment. I try not to think about the world at all, which can get difficult at times, especially when you're trained to automatically be thinking about, okay, how can we stage this?
I have the same dilemma as a director.
Oh, yeah. Oh, of course. Yeah. It's so hard. Once you start doing that, like you see everything through that lens.
Or watching a show and not letting your director brain take over, I'm sure. I mean, we can talk a little bit more maybe after about if you watch shows differently, but yeah.
It changes everything. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Yeah, yes. Cool. So after you read the script a couple times.
Yeah. So I read the script a couple of times, get a feel for it. Then I like to do a preliminary pull. So a lot of, like, I've had 3-hour conversations just over photos with some directors, where we each take like 50 to 100 images that really speak to us. And we discuss like, why is this particular shape speaking to us? Why is this weird clown figure kind of important? And we found that there are 10 clowns in this, but this show has nothing to do with clowns. So what's that about? So pulling those images and kind of getting a basis for what we want the world to be. Then from that point, I do some napkin sketches, just some very basic, like, hey, here's what I think the shape is going to be. We've got this type of stage. Here's how I think we can use it. And then a lot of this is going back to the director, back to the design team, and kind of creating this as a collaborative effort of what we want the world to be. But typically, I will take that basic sketch and then turn it into something more resembling what the world actually is. So translating the set into a color rendering, something similar to what an architect would do, basically trying to recreate the world to the best ability. And then really the end package where I could say that the design is quote unquote finished is turning into a ground plan, something called a ground plan, and then a series of elevations and working drawings. What those basically are is very similar to architecture or interior design. This is the exact placement of all of these elements. It's how big they are. It's how tall they are. It is what color we want to make them. It's how they interact with each other. And it's really setting out the blueprints for what the set is going to be. So that's kind of where I would end just as a designer. Now, especially since I'm early in my career, I find that I am still building a lot of the productions that I'm designing. I'm still painting the productions that I'm designing. So from that point, I then actually need to create the world. But depending on the project, we have teams of carpenters, painters, and technical directors who take my design drawings and say, "You're absolutely crazy. We can't do this, but we can do this." And so you adapt it based on budget, based on limitations, based on kind of all of the really quirky and interesting challenges that come with staging a play.
And I love that, you know, you talked about, you know, pictures and things, so you can kind of be on the same wavelength. I feel that there's a weird stigma with it, because I think it's definitely more of a feminine platform. But just how much I use Pinterest in my theater career these days, you know, both communicating with my designers and communicating with my actors when it's, you know, world building and design choices and mood and atmosphere or time period, when I'm like, oh, you know, you or like, you know, I had a string of shows in the 80s from like Fame and Footloose and things, and trying to explain to teenagers now just like the fashion of the time. I'm just like, Pinterest board. Do you use Pinterest a lot, or like what sort of like everyday technology besides, you know, you talked about like your drafting software, but like what are the tools of the trade?
As far as the actual tools of the trade, Pinterest is great for research. Google Photos, great for research. Just going on Google Images there. I start by taking Google Photos and just doing a gigantic pull. So it could be 100 photos, it could be 150 photos, but it's really like scrolling through for about 2 hours and seeing what catches my eye and what I think could be relevant. One of the things that different designers will give different opinions on is whether, say you're staging Macbeth, whether you look at who has done Macbeth in the past, and who has done all of these other shows, just to see, you know, kind of taking inspiration from them. I typically don't like to do that. I like to avoid Same. Other productions as much as possible.
Yes.
Especially if you have something crazy that you want to put a spin on it with. I tend to do a lot of collages, which is taking those photos and more like providing a little bit more of a stylized element, so that I can try to show a little bit of that escalation. But really, it's different for a lot of designers. I think a lot of people, some don't do a lot of research, and they just jump like wholly into sketch form. Some people don't even sketch, and they just immediately start drafting. For me, it kind of depends on the project. Past that point, I do a lot of sketching on my iPad. I find that I'm not as good with pencil and paper. So that's been something that I've found has been a lot easier for me, just to have my iPad out with some sketching apps so that I can recreate some shapes and I can easily go back in and tweak things without needing to completely erase and start over. Sometimes, depending on the project, we build a lot of models. So it's taking the sketch and actually replicating the theater. Whether you're actually building the models out of foam and paper and spray paint and doing all of that, or using a program. What a lot of people do now is use AutoCAD, which is computer-aided design. So that's whether it is the AutoCAD brand name or whether it's Vectorworks. SketchUp is another popular one. Dan, I know that you use that.
Yeah, free to me is good to me, and SketchUp is, I mean, it's not the most intuitive thing, but I, you know, when I need to just kind of get a base look, SketchUp has been my friend.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's really what's the most accessible and what helps you convey your ideas. Because at the end of the day, this is all about taking what's in somebody's head and turning it into reality. Mm-hmm. So I've seen people do like so many different methods. I know some people, my mentor at college, strictly hand drafts. He goes through and he does every single thing by hand. And these technical drawings are practically they are artworks. By the end of it. And it's really beautiful to see. But it's all about taking that idea and bringing it into reality. So it's kind of what I talk about with other designers about the process is to really use whatever you're the most comfortable with.
I always wish that I was craftier, like with like building things, because I've always wanted to be the director that has like the scale model. Because I've worked with a couple of directors that, you know, can or designers that build a really good scale model, and then you can actually like play with it and use it for different blocking things. But I'm not, you know, on that scale, can't, you know, I struggle with that.
Definitely an acquired skill. It wasn't something that I was particularly good at.
Yeah.
I was the kind of person where I fell in love with creating the worlds, but I didn't know how to do it yet. And so I had to kind of beat myself into submission with creating the models and doing all of that. It's such a weirdly satisfying process, though. Like, just to build a small, tiny, like, quarter-inch scale house.
Yeah, no, I definitely can't remember what the project was and what I was... it was probably a show like I was props master for or something, but I just remember that the designer made like a half-inch scale model thing and made little people on popsicle sticks so the director could actually, you know, test all their blocking and their stage pictures. And I'm like, oh, I love that. I wish I could have that for every show. And I have had that for exactly zero shows because, you know, a lot of times I'm designing my own set and I'm a very... I think just because, like, I'm more focused on the directing, I'm just a very practical designer, so I'm just like, great, everything's square, there's some stairs, because I need a level, great, done.
Oh, disgusting, Dan, disgusting. Yeah,
I know. Again, I'm not a set designer, but I design sets, if that's how I try to explain it, same thing. It's like, I'm not a lighting, I would think it would be insulting to real designers if I was like, oh yeah, I'm a lighting designer. It's like, no, I design lights, but I'm not a lighting designer. I can... put together a dance, but I am not a choreographer, which is why, you know, I'm hoping that as Q0 grows, we can be collaborating with people like yourself more often, so we can have some more creative designs and less of my practical designs. Let's kind of build off of that, talking about the collaborative process. When you're working with a director, you touched upon, you know, sometimes they've got a very clear vision and you're just kind of making that a reality, and other times they're giving you different, you know, whether it's a mood and atmosphere or time period and kind of letting you do your own thing. What sorts of directors do you enjoy most collaborating with? And like what are things that, you know, directors give you that give you the best to work with?
It varies on the projects too, because they're essentially kind of, there are different types of shows that each come with like really radically different challenges. So say when you're designing a Shakespeare, a lot of times the struggle is that you either want to completely make it your own, or you want to completely honor the original time period and the original everything about the script. Versus if you have an original work or a musical for that matter that has all of these different elements that are kind of iconic. So, for example, I was working on, or I still am, pending COVID things, working on a production of 42nd Street, which is, of course, just a very iconic musical. Right. And there are so many images that you really need to honor. So there are some points when you can't break away too much. But in general, looking at the directors that I like to work with, I think it's those who have an appreciation for the design elements. I think that being able to sit down and geek out about shapes for 3 hours is something that's interesting. I was working with a director on a filmed adaptation of a stage play where we spent 2.5 hours talking about what picnic tables mean. And it was like the most absurd conversation to anybody else.
The arbitrary, like the symbolic meaning of a picnic table, I can't even...
Really,
like
how movement around a picnic table influences the character dynamic. That's, and it was totally related to the story.
No, I can see that, but I couldn't imagine. I don't know. I guess I'd have to see the piece. Like someone asked me why I own 3 different books on interpreting dreams at one time, and I'm just like, because, you know, I like to look at them for the symbology, and sometimes, you know, things mean other things on a subconscious level, but picnic table's a new one.
It was a new one for me too, but it was a very interesting conversation. But especially like working with directors that really are excited to bring the worlds to life. And they say, I really want to create something that's dynamic and engaging. I think that one of the worst pitfalls that you can fall into is just wanting the bare minimum. Which sometimes for the budget and for the production that you're in, that's really all you can get. But really, even with the smallest budget, we can still create art. And so directors that see the worlds as art pieces, in addition to the performance, I think that's when you get a really interesting collaborative atmosphere, which comes from all of the other design team too. I mean, working with the costume designer, the lighting designer, working with properties designers or paint charges, all of those different elements, they all kind of build off of each other. which is one of the great things about theater, is when you have so many different voices in the room with so many different experiences, we kind of realize that our ideas maybe aren't always the best ones. So we can kind of build off of that and create something that we might not have seen in the first place.
Yes.
But is still like almost like so much more powerful because it has so many different voices speaking through it.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. And one of my favorite things about working with a good designer or team of designers is when they ask me questions I haven't thought of and I have to go, I need to think about that. And then, you know, they really make me justify my choices. And I always recommend people, like, don't just surround yourself with yes men or people that are got very similar ideas to you. You got to be open and ready to change. You either have to be open and ready to change your mind or ready to justify your choices. So when you've got a good designer that's like, well, why are we doing that? Have you thought of this? Then you either have to, you know, disprove them by backing up your choices or, you know, change your mind because they've, you know, presented a good argument. So that's a wonderful part to me of the collaborative process. You start talking about, like, you know, working with your other designers. Say you're working on a production that you actually have, you know, like a fully staffed design team. So say you're like, there's a set designer, a lighting designer, a costume designer, a props master. When you're trying to unify the world, I know, like, a lot of times that should come from the director, but, like, what are the challenges in having the cohesion, especially if you're on, like, a community theater schedule where it's, like, you've got to get everything into the theater built, hung, focused in 12 hours, go. What are the challenges or the benefits of having a large, fully staffed design team versus maybe just kind of having a master designer and when it comes to, you know, unifying the world?
Yeah, it can make a world of a difference, especially when you're dealing with those tight time frames. A lot of the time, the solution for me that I found is that we just start this process incredibly early. I was designing a film that actually started filming in February of 2020. So we wrapped up, and so it's being worked on right now. I think it's going to be released in June or July area. But we started talking about, I started talking with the director, Bill Humphreys, about that project a year before we even built it. So we spent several months talking about the world and really collaborating before there were any stakes and before really anything was involved. So we were able to really nail down what the world was so that once timelines were crunching, that wasn't even a concern anymore. That was something that we had already kind of worked through and we had gained something that we were really happy with. Of course, the situations of any process require change and adaptation. And once you run into problems and budgets and things like that, that can shift. But I think that when you have more voices in the room, it just becomes more important that you honor and recognize the strengths that everybody brings to the table. If there's just one master designer, anything that they say kind of goes. And so it could be great. But I think what happens a lot of the time is that they're often overworked or they just don't have the time to be producing their best work. So what you get is kind of something that is relatively cohesive and can be good, but is a lot more taxing on the entire process. When you have a full team who's dedicated just to their small, not small, but dedicated to their area, they bring it all. And they bring that same collaborative spirit towards the entire process. A lot of the shows that I work on, it's a little bit of the director has the overall concept and the overall idea for the production. And then I set the world that it's in. And then off of that world, the costume designer and the lighting designer and the properties designer, if we have one, sometimes I do both, they kind of riff off of that world and take inspiration from it. Mm. So it's kind of that hierarchy
that
goes down. But there are some times when a costume designer has an amazing piece, an amazing sketch that they worked on, and the director said, this is it. This is the world.
Right.
And you take inspiration from that. And so it's really like when everybody is focusing and operating at their A game, and you just have some awareness of keeping cohesiveness, keeping that cohesion throughout the show, I think that's when magic happens. That's when the real surprise of creating something dynamic and interesting does occur.
One thing you touched upon that's very near and dear to Q0 is new works. What sort of challenges come from trying to design for a play that might, or a piece that might be in workshop, where, you know, you've got the script, you read the script, and you start making your design, and then a week later, you've got a new script, and, you know, things are completely different. And then, you know, if you want to build off of that, like, what sort of things can be done to mitigate any challenges or hurdles that do occur when you're working on a new piece?
It's painful in the best possible way, Dan. I think that's like the easiest way to put it. I absolutely adore working on new works. I think that it is such an incredible creative challenge, and requires so much more adaptation throughout it. But it's a very fascinating process. There are some times when plays are written that are really impossible to be staged. And it's something that was just like the brainchild of this creator. We have no idea if it's possible. And so you kind of need to assess that. And then there are some times when it's really something that is constantly changing. Like, I've started on productions that didn't have a full script yet. And so throughout that process, we had a rough idea of the world, but there was something where you just need to be aware of that change. And a little bit of it is getting on top of it as soon as possible, because sometimes it'll change in the rehearsal room. And so saying, I'm not going to build this piece until said date, because I know that they're going to look at this. And once they look at this scene, they might want a different drop, or they might want a different element that's going to be lit a little bit differently. And it's really kind of keeping that collaborative atmosphere. But it's also so interesting just to see kind of the process with the writer in the room, to be able to honor the writer's words. There are sometimes, and not all the time, when I actually get to work with the writer as a part of the design process, but I find that's such a fascinating and interesting aspect. Because they really, if you talk about the people who know the world, the writers know the world better than anybody. Because it was their baby, it's something that they created. And so finding that is really fascinating. As far as mitigating challenges, I think that the easiest way is to just have a sense for what could happen. I think that the worst thing that you can do is design yourself into a hole, or say, hey, this is what the set is. Nothing's going to change, because nothing's going to change. And I think the one constant is change. And so you find that inevitably things are going to happen. Songs or scenes are going to get cut, and we're going to require different things. And so it engages a different part of your brain as a designer, as a director, as a performer, to really be able to mold something completely new.
What's the like latest you've ever had to either scrap a major design element, or maybe even like an entire design? And I mean, it doesn't even necessarily have to be a new work. If you listen to our interview with the stage managers, one of our stage managers told a horror story of a director that was trying to add some major spectacle elements that weren't discussed before Tech Week, when they're like, oh, maybe we should have this, like 10 feet in the air swing added to this scene. And it's like, wait, what? No. Let's try to avoid that sort of thing. But like, what's the latest you've had to like scrap something, and like, how do you, or make a major change, and how do you, you know, reconcile with that?
Oh, it can be rough. Especially if the project is your baby. I'm trying to think back to what I'm allowed to say here.
if there's something that in retrospect you want edited out, just let me know.
Yeah, sure, I will. I think that one of the most dramatic examples would probably be, and I won't name the show or the theater out of respect for everybody, but it was early in my career. I think I designed the set when I was maybe 15 or 16. And so while designing and building the set, I was also acting in the production. And that was like a quasi community theater. Like, we were still getting paid, but it was kind of a community level theater. And so really we had built everything, we had rental drops in, and we put it all on the stage, and the executive director of the theater came in and essentially said, oh, this doesn't work. Oh, I don't like this at all. And so immediately was like, not really a fan of this. And so, of course, we sat down, we talked about it, and we realized that there were so many elements that just weren't really working, because we tried to go too much spectacle. Very similar right. to the swing set. Like, we tried to do so many other things that pulled it apart from what mattered, which was the story. And so in this move, in the second day of tech, we struck 80% of the set. 80% of it just went out the window. The entire, like, the budget just scrapped.
Right.
And yeah. And I was devastated at first. Truly, because it was like just starting out, like one of the first designs I'd ever done, and it just got scrapped. And from that point, I was like, well, I mean, I don't know if we're even going to get positive reviews or anything on this. And the reviews came out 2 weeks later, and they loved the set. They were like, this is beautiful. This is exactly what it needs. It's elegant. It's simple. It's perfect. And I was like, well, shoot, I guess the director was right.
So are you like do you agree with the less is more approach, or is it dependent on the piece?
It's absolutely dependent upon the piece. Some things really require spectacle.
Yes.
Like, to do a minimalistic version of Shrek would not work as well. I think that can be said.
I'm sure, but there's some fringe company that's going to want to do a five-person bizarre avant-garde Shrek that's just going to be terrible.
Oh, I can't wait. I can't wait. But, like, you've got those shows which are like the blockbuster musicals. You've got right. the Broadway hits. But then you've got a piece like Waiting for Godot. I think, like, Beckett, like any Beckett play, I'm a massive Beckett fan. Beckett plays are a great example of what you can do with less. And so there's so many shows where really what matters is the story, and what matters is what people need to take away from the world that we're in. Right. So that can mean a lot of different things. There are some elements, like I was talking about with 42nd Street, where like the actual, like the collage of theater signs and the actual marquee lights is so huge to some of those numbers. Whereas like a chorus line, like the mirror is so important.
Yes.
Like cabaret, you have to have a cabaret sign or something there. But there's so many other areas where you can really play with it and strip it down to see what you really need. And it's kind of, it depends on the director. It depends on the process. Obviously budget plays into that. I mean, I've worked with anywhere from like a $50 budget to like a $15,000 budget on a set. And each requires the same process. It's that same way of kind of realizing the world.
Right.
So sometimes less is more, and it can be good. But there are also times when the spectacle is just so much fun.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. You know, I've worked with directors and designers that are more is more people, no matter what the project. And that, to me, is incredibly frustrating, even as an audience member. But, you know, you're right. There are shows like if Moulin Rouge didn't have 500 lighting cues in the first 5 minutes of the show, that wouldn't have been them doing the show justice incorrectly. But if you're right, you know, your production of Waiting for Godot or Our Town had 500 lighting cues in the first 5 minutes, what did you just do?
The worst crime is over designing Our Town. Like the worst theater crime.
I mean, I think the worst crime is just staging a production of Our Town, but that's a story for another discussion.
Hello, Q0 fans. Q0 business advisor and performer Jake Ranlett here, interrupting your regularly scheduled podcast to talk about Q0 sponsorship and membership. As I'm sure you know, theater is really expensive, and we cannot survive on ticket sales alone, which is why we have these two awesome programs that not only allow Q0 to continue to revolutionize the performing arts scene in New Hampshire, but has incredible benefits for you as well. Sponsors get their name and logo in our playbill, on our posters, mentioned in our podcasts, listed on our press releases, and so much more. We go out of our way to make sure everyone knows about you and thanks you for helping make Q0 possible. We also have our membership program for individuals who want a little bit more bang for their buck and a lot more Q0 in their lives. We have 10 different levels of membership, starting as low as $2 a month. Every level of membership comes with awesome perks, such as early access to the Q0 Theater Cast, discounts on tickets and merchandise, exclusive behind-the-scenes video content, the ability to read our new works blog, and so much more. The more you give, the more you get. If you want to be a vital part of the Q0 revolution, head on over to czthreater.com and click the Support CZT link to become a sponsor or a member today. And now, back to the podcast.
But I want to build off, because you talked about like 42nd Street and Cabaret, which, you know, I jotted down as a note, just balancing like original thought and unique designs with iconic things that people expect. And that's something I struggle with as a director sometimes. Like, I am very like adamant. I do not watch somebody else's production before I, you know, I'm serving the text and nothing like in the playwright's wishes and intent. And that's what I'll research. And I try to avoid other productions, but you're right. There are shows where if you don't have, you know, all of the Broadway marquees in your 42nd Street design, or if you, you know, like right now or right before everything shut down, there was the first time in 60 whatever years that there was going to be a professional production of West Side Story on Broadway that didn't have Jerome Robbins choreography. And some people are like, oh, I'm glad they're taking this risk. Whether it paid off or not was a different story. And other people are like, that's blasphemy. Jerome Robbins choreography is West Side Story. And I, you know, I had that same thing with when I directed like Fiddler on the Roof, and there's just certain iconography with certain shows. So like, how do you deal with trying to balance that as a designer? Do you ever feel like, you know, maybe you hate the original design? Like, I've had that where like someone's like, oh, this is how they always do it. And I'm like, okay, but I read the script and that doesn't make any sense. yeah. So how do you balance that?
My biggest pet peeve as a designer is when I'll go into a process with a show that is relatively well known or has received a lot of other productions. And when we talk about the design, they say, well, Broadway did this. So that this is the way that I want it done. And that can be so infuriating, especially because like my job is not to recreate the Broadway vision. The Broadway designers already did that. It's also incredibly immoral and kind of illegal right, to rip off all of those things.
I mean, I know a theater that will remain nameless that did almost get sued because their set design was too close to the tour, and they actually had to do some like side-by-side photos point out the differences to be like, see, we've got six differences. Okay, if we'd only had five, that you'd be in court right now, but you've got six, so you're okay.
Yeah, it's a really slippery slope. And especially talking with a lot of other designers, that's one of the most important things, is making sure that that we keep creative control over our designs and our creations, and that we can still put our own spins on something that is iconic. One of my favorite feelings, and it doesn't happen a lot, but I really love it when it does, is when you take an iconic production and I go in with my first meeting with the director and they say, I want to do something completely different, but that still serves the script. And that's always a really fun challenge. One example of that is a production actually of Peter Pan Jr. that I'm currently working on. We're working with Disney Theatrics. They're releasing a different, a more modern kind of adapted script. And so we were one of the first companies to actually be given permission to operate and to perform this show. But one of the core aspects that the director wanted was that we wanted to interpret the script and interpret the story of Peter Pan in something that was truly original, but that still spoke to the heart of what it was. So I read the script like a bazillion times. And what I came back to was looking at what the story really was about, which for me, the way that I saw it was this element of childhood imagination, of play, of remaining youthful, and of making sure that, like, creating one's own world and one's own youth within their minds. And so my concept for the show was to stage it entirely in a playground. And so the actors are actually interacting with the world, and the flying was going to be done on swing sets. And we would have merry-go-rounds and projections and all of these different elements where the actors could really create their own worlds and embrace their own inner child and their inner playful nature. And so that's one of the most interesting things for me, to honor, like, the iconic images of Peter Pan. It isn't so much the image of the green Peter Pan outfit. Yes, that's visually iconic, but one of the most surprising things is to take what the icons really mean. Like, the symbolism behind the iconography is what I really strive for, because it's not so much the visuals, it's what those visuals relate to. And it's what the audience kind of sees out of that. So if you look at Chorus Line, well, not Chorus Line, I'll stop referring to that, but like, the element of those marquee signs is that the feeling that is important out of those icons is the city being so immersive, and the city of New York being the entire world in that moment, where once the lights come on, that's everything to them. Show business is everything to them. And capturing that essence, like with Chicago, when you have the seductive nature of, like, the bars and playing with the dangerousness of prison versus show business and all of those different elements, taking the razzle dazzle of that in your own sense is what's really intriguing.
You kind of mentioned, you know, finding, like, the essence there, and I harken back to, there was there was not that long a period of time between seeing two different productions of Spamalot for me. And if you had told me, like, you're doing Spamalot would be a show that I'm like, I don't really want to do that, because I'm just going to be expected to copy all of the Monty Python iconography. And I'm like, where's the challenge both in directing it and in designing for it? So I saw one, like, big budget, let's recreate everything from Broadway production of Spamalot, and it actually felt a little hollow. Whereas then, like, maybe only like 2 or 3 months later, I went to see this, I don't want to say low budget, but definitely on a budget production of Spamalot that, you know, it had a couple of things that it took right from the original Broadway, but for the most part, it made things their own where they could, and it just felt so much more authentic and entertaining and engaging, because there was more, because, like, everybody understood that worked on the project the thought behind it, rather than just being like, well, this is what people expect. So I appreciate that. I'm talking to a designer with similar sentiments, and I want to put that out there to all of our theater artists, both new and old. Make sure you understand the why and the how, and you can justify your choices, and not just, you know, they say, like, in corporate, you know, the corporate world, there's no deadlier phrase than, well, that's how we've always done it. I think in theater, there's no deadlier phrase than, well, that's how they did it on Broadway. You know, you've got to understand the why. And yes, you can, like, shot for shot, angle for angle, or whatever, recreate something, but you have to know, you know, the inner guts of it.
Yeah, and especially since, like, the actual, what these icons mean changes over time, too. Mm. Like, that's why, like, if you have something that is so iconic and so visceral for people, in 20 years, it may not have that same effect. It may have the completely opposite effect, where something that you thought was charming is now incredibly offensive.
Yes.
So that's something that we need to balance.
Yeah, and I mean, I even have that with, like, some scripts. I always argue that I think in our lifetime we're going to see, you know, they say, you know, if you want to draw an audience, you do Annie or you do Grease. But I think we're going to hit a point where those shows will stop drawing because so much of those scripts are pop culture references. And eventually your audience isn't going to remember Harpo Marx or this joke about Herbert Hoover or why it's, you know, Annie solves the Great Depression and that's hilarious. But like, you know, where people are removed from these things, it's the same thing. It's like, you know, the song Look at Me, I'm Sandra Dee in Grease is all 1950s pop culture references.
Yeah.
At what, like, is that song still entertaining? Or like you even get to a point where it's like, oh, I didn't get it. And then like your grandfather is like, well, Annette was so-and-so and, you know, God, what's the other, you know, Elvis or whatever. And you're like, yeah. oh, okay. Now I get it. Ha ha.
Yeah. I mean, it's such a slippery slope.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's really a matter of accessibility for a lot of people, too. Like, one of the beautiful aspects of working on new works is that it's so accessible for their target audience. Like, Annie is really great for a certain audience. It's a good family show and for people 45, 50 and up, like, to get all of those different elements of it, which could be great for your audience. But there's a lot of times that if you want to create something that's accessible, fresh, and current, that keeping these more timeless aspects is important. Like part of what makes a show like Les Miserables, or if you want to pull just from stories like Don Quixote, like what makes those so iconic and really so relevant still today is that it doesn't speak to references. It speaks to elements about what it means to be a person. And that's one of the most important aspects of theater is kind of addressing what it means to be a part of society or to be a human being. Like, that's what's really cool for me is analyzing all of these timeless aspects. And whether that comes in terms of the world that we're building or the set that we're putting on stage, or whether it's just something inherent to the story. I think that's what really matters.
So like, what would be like the biggest piece of advice you would give into somebody who wants to go into design, whether it's a teenager looking at colleges or even maybe, you know, an adult that's done community theater for a while, that's always been like, you know, maybe I could go into set, you know, design the set for the next show. What would you give them for a piece of advice?
I'd say the baseline is to see everything you can, whether it is film, whether it is plays, musicals, avant-garde, stage works, dance shows, just take in as much as humanly possible, because I can guarantee you that it will change your definition of what theater is and what theater can be. Go see the kinds of things that you don't think people are going to see. Like, it doesn't always need to be the Broadway hit. I've seen some really terrific experimental works that have completely changed the way that I look at theater and completely changed the way that I act as a designer. Past that point, I would say practice what you do as much as possible. Whether that is going to a theater and saying, listen, I'm just starting out. Can I just help build a set? Can I help just throw me a paintbrush? I can texture some things, or throw me a screw gun. I can help you build some flats. Getting in whatever way possible, I think is so important. And practicing regardless of if you have a production coming up, like feel free to sketch out what you think shows could be and what you think things could do. It's the same thing as performing in a way. You just need to practice as much as possible. Practice, see everything, and don't be afraid to say yes to things. A lot of what I've experienced, and I'm very lucky for it, is opportunities that scared me and opportunities that were things that I felt that I was really weak in. And so whenever I saw something that was like, I think I'm going to be terrible at this, I'm going to say yes, because that is the best way to get better, is to take those areas that you think are your weak spots and turn them into your strengths. So I think that those are like a couple of things that I would recommend to anybody starting out.
All brilliant advice, all great things. Last question, and it's kind of a two-parter because it's for two different people. So I asked this of the stage managers, and now I want to ask it of a designer. What is something you would like actors to know that would make your life easier? And then same thing, what is something you would like to say to directors that would make your life easier as a designer?
Oh, those are good questions. I think
Thank you.
Yeah. I think that for actors, at least, there's an element of, and I was guilty of this when I was starting out as an actor, of realizing what your creative team does do for you and does do for your production. Because we're working not only to make the world and the set the most interesting thing possible, but we're working to make you look the best you possibly can. And so to have that element of appreciation is great. I had an actor when I was working as a props designer for a show in Boston. I had an actor come complaining to a director because a prop that I built, a map, was too realistic. And it was turning them out of the scene, and they were too busy looking at the map. That was a legitimate complaint that was put through this director, and it's one of my favorite moments in like my entire career so far, is that a prop I made was too prop. And so there's like the general of actors, try to be easy on your props if you can, but also appreciate the craft, what people are doing. Because we are all artists. We're all bringing this story to life. And so recognizing and seeing the work that we're doing as something that is an integral part of the process, it makes us feel a hell of a lot better. And it really creates a more collaborative atmosphere. I've had actors come up and like geek out about a scenic element that I put in. And that just makes my heart swell because I geeked out about their monologue they just gave. And so to have like that sort of collaborative nature. For directors, I think that number one, just recognize that we have a budget and we're trying really hard to stick within it. in general, like it's a very similar thing where recognizing that there's a reason why we're all here and why we're all collaborating together, creating, and especially creating theater, is a naturally abrasive process. Like our goal with each production is to put people who are going to have conflicting opinions, because it's going to test what we can do. And it's going to make sure that we have the most artistically sound product, the most engaging product, and something that we can all be proud of to continue. So it's kind of one of the best things is when I have a director who's aware of what we all bring to the table. And one of the worst things is to have a director who thinks that their concept is king in 100% of the time. And there are times when it can be. And there are times when that is the most important thing. But there are other times when allowing the designers to do their work and to help create maybe not what you think you need, but what you actually want. I think that's huge.
Great advice. Definitely things I will try to apply in my own work as a director and as a designer. And just complaining that a prop is too realistic, I'm just, that one's going to keep me up at night. Justin, we've been recording for over an hour. It's pushing up against dinner time. As much as I love, everything we've talked about, and I could talk this forever, we'll have to have you on the podcast again in the not too distant future. But thank you so much for this interview. It was great to chat with you, and we'll have to find a Q0 season 3 project so you can come collaborate with us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. This has been wonderful.
Thank you once again to Justin for that insightful interview. It was just delightful to talk theater with you. I love getting to share my passion with equally as passionate people, and I hope everybody listening also enjoyed it. Again, I'm not feeling like rambling on too much today. We're already almost up against an hour with the length of this episode. So, I'll just, finish with my normal. Hope everybody's staying safe out there. Be on the lookout for announcements regarding Q0 soon. With the ongoing pandemic, we're definitely got some plans that will be changing. Let's end on our positive note. So one final time, this is Artistic Director Dan Pelletier. And as we always say, support local theater and join the revolution.